seated. Great. I see you got a cup of coffee.
Oh, yeah,
that's
thanks.
Good. Yep.
Very nice.
All right. So, have you got any final questions? Yeah.
Mr. Shen, are you aware that Plan Change 7 doesn't capture Resource Management Act permits to dam water, but does capture deemed permits to dam water?
Yes.
Would you be able to identify relatively quickly which of the high or medium and high PIC dams in Otago are subject to, I'm not asking you to do it now, are you able to identify which ones are deemed permit dams?
Certainly, based on this list, is it?
Or, yeah, well, have you got access to information that would allow you to do that?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
So that's capturing medium to high PIC, and I forgot what PIC meant, but...
Potential impact classification.
Potential impact classification.
Yeah.
That are deemed permit dams.
Because if you are medium to high potential impact classification, then what then captured by the reg? Captured by the guidelines or captured by the Building Act or RMA? Can you remind me again?
So it's not just the low ones come under the guidelines too. So
yeah.
Yeah, so low, medium or high, yeah. All are covered in the NSOL guidelines.
Yeah. So why would you exclude low impact classification from the deemed permit suite?
Just looking at this list here, none of these are low, so it doesn't really come into it.
Okay,
these are all medium and high that I'll be talking to.
This is your list of 23?
No, this is...
I don't know what that list is. 30, you know, the list that you had up there on the screen, you had a list of either... 23 or in the 30s, 32, 23.
Correct, Your Honour. So that was just the Central Otago ones, and I've had a few outliers.
A few more than that.
Yes, there was. Yeah.
Okay. In those list of dams that we saw on the screen, are they all medium to high impact, or medium to high potential impact classification?
No, there's some lows on there too.
Some lows in there too. Okay.
Those are just large dams.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. That threshold.
Yes.
So what I propose to do, Mum, is to winnow out from the evidence that you've got which ones are deemed permit structures, because that's the ones of relevance to PC7, and the witness says he can do that for us, so I'm simply going to offer to have him produce a table of those once he's left the witness box.
Alrighty. What do you think?
That information would be useful, and it's something we were working jointly on putting together in any event. I suspect the question is how we have that information produced and whether this witness can produce that information now. Are you in a position to produce that information now, or is that work that you would need to go away and do and come back to the court with that table?
Well, if we're just talking to the list that yourself and Mr. Page have, we can do that today.
That's the lawyer's evidence, is it? you know, it's your evidence.
Right.
What are the deemed permits? I don't know how to phrase this. What medium to high potential impact dams which have a medium to high PIC? Are also subject to deemed permits. Now, I don't know what I do know what deemed permits are, but I don't know whether that's taken use or impounding or what that is.
Sure.
So I suspect you may know, or you may have to work in with ORC perhaps in terms of its databases. I'm not happy that you confirm a list produced by lawyers, because they're not giving evidence and we want to know what's in, what's out.
Sure.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's fair enough, isn't it? Otherwise, it's your evidence. You might as well swear yourselves in.
Well, what deemed permits exist is a matter of public record, and what I was attempting to do was to refine that because this is the engineering expert who can tell us which ones...
Yeah, but it's still your evidence. And we, you know, if it's important to know, then it has to be verified that these are the deemed permits, whatever that means, and these are the high to medium PICM structures. Not your evidence. It is your planner working in with your engineer.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, perhaps I'll discuss with Mr. Moore about what's the best
still
way to
do it. Still not his evidence either. I'm really, going to be firm on this. It has to come from your witnesses.
Yes, I understand that. But between us, we might be able to devise a way which the Regional Council is happy about how the evidence is produced and by whom. And so that
you actually have to make me happy, the bench happy. That's how this works. So you need to think about this. You need to think about this.
Yes. Well, it's really about identifying what the scope of Plan Change 7 is, because that's what we're trying to do, is to identify which dams are PC7 dams and which ones aren't.
Well, I've said all I'm going to say.
Well, I've got no further questions for the witness.
Right, thank you. You've got questions?
I do have some questions. Yep. Thank you. Good morning. You gave some evidence this morning in relation to the transfer of functions under the Building Act with respect to Otago and Southland. Are you aware that both Otago Regional Council and Southland Regional Council have recently transferred those functions to the Canterbury Regional Council?
I knew they were doing that, Mr. Moore, so I think I mentioned that, Your Honour. Yes, I knew that was coming up. In discussions with OIC, they've raise that with me.
Now, when you think about the dams that you have a working knowledge of within the Otago region and the dams that you are involved with in terms of the maintenance and dam safety programs, have I understood your evidence correctly that there's no imminent threat of dam failure in the short term, and short term I mean the next 6 years?
With the dams that I look after, today there is no imminent danger, but if something were to change in that period, then so I can't say that nothing's going to happen in 6 years. There is every likelihood that there'll be indicators that post-flood or post-earthquake that may indicate that or may trigger a response in that period.
So there's no current deferred maintenance that is not being carried out on these structures at present that might compromise their safety and integrity?
What I've done for all of the dam owners, hydro and irrigation, is prepare spreadsheets of listing the work activities that perhaps I've identified or previous engineers have identified, and then I've prioritised them and I've tried to put dollars around them, and working with the owners, so working with the irrigation boards, talk them through what it is and why we're doing things, and put them in a position to, because they need to release those funds to do the work, to give them some sort of sense of understanding about what is going to be done and why it needs to be done. So there's some items of work that have higher priority, and I would say over the next 24 months we would definitely want to address those issues, and then the others over, be a 5-year rolling program, as most of them that I put together.
So putting to one side the resource management permits, is it your experience that the dam safety and the maintenance obligations are existing outside of the Resource Management Act process?
I can't comment about the Resource Management Act process, really.
Was your question more geared towards Building Act? Yeah, can you comment about the Building Act process?
Okay, so the 5-yearly inspections are documents that are prepared, are public documents. So in the case of the Logan Burn, if we use that as an example, where there might have been at least 40 items of work, and some of those are quite major items that Mr. Walsh, the dam engineer I referenced before, identified as needing done. So I took those and I prioritised those, and because they are a public document, when he submitted that to the Manikato Irrigation Company, it was also submitted to council, regional council, and so they were aware that this outstanding work had to be, managed. Now the process actually allows me to push back on behalf of the irrigators or the generators. I can say that I think he's been pedantic, or that he's been too conservative, or we'll manage an issue differently than how he may see it. In the case of what Mr. Walsh put together, we diligently followed that through, and there's only one item that we're outstanding on, and it's been addressed as we speak, and the 5-yearly inspection, the engineers involved in that, I want them to comment on the information that's been a bit late coming in, but that will be part of the next 5-yearly investigation that's just been done. It'll be reported on. So even if they may say, well, you haven't done it, and why not? And, my answer probably would be, if it was impact item, it's really not a concern, but in this case it actually is a point of significance, and so I'm not embarrassed, but I'm a bit concerned that we haven't got that information to them, because I really do want them to comment on it. Yeah, sorry, I've been a wee bit long-winded there, but there is a process, and OIC are part of that process all the way through, and they need to be part of it.
So as issues arise with these dams, do you follow a process of identifying swiftly what the risk profile of an issue is to determine how quickly it might need to be responded to?
Yeah, that would be part of the, the investigation phase for sure. Yeah, and so under the guidelines and under the old regulations, actually, if it's an emergency, because you've got an awful lot of water sitting back there, you've got carte blanche. You can just rock in there with diggers and bulldozers and whatever you need. You'd have to justify that afterwards, of course. But other than that, there's a process that needs to be followed, and inevitably it's going to be peer-reviewed, and potentially it's going to end up in legal stoush, because who's going to pay and all that sort of thing. And so it needs to be really rigorous, that type of thing. So Ross Creek was a great example. Yeah. There's some head-banging went on over that job, and but they've come up with a great solution and everyone's happy.
Now, in your written evidence in chief, do you have a copy of that with you?
Mine? Oh, yep. Yes, I have.
I want to take you to your paragraph 8, the last sentence of that paragraph.
Yep.
And here you refer to the evidence you give relates to the permits for the dam structures. I'm interested to know which permits you had in mind when you wrote this part of your evidence. So what are you referring to in this context?
I knew about the dam permits, but I didn't know about the details behind those dam permits. So probably more in relation to the Building Act, as Your Honour said before. Mm.
Your paragraph 15, you refer to Module 7 of the NSOLD guidelines.
Yep.
And you make reference there that those guidelines are operating regardless of consenting processes under the RMA.
Correct.
So is it fair to say it's the guidelines that are driving the maintenance and the management programs in relation to these dams, not any permits issued under the RMA?
Again, I can't comment on the dam permits because I don't have that background, but remembering that the guidelines used to sit under the regulations, and I know we're floating in the wind at the moment, but the industry, and when I say industry, I'm including ORC, are supportive of what the NSOLD guidelines bring in terms of ongoing stability or ongoing safety of these structures. So, remembering that the regulatory people, in particular ORC has had representation in the NSOLD, were very much a part of putting those NSOLD guidelines together, which is great.
Thank you. No further questions.
Ms. Baker Galloway. Re-examination. So, Councillor, I've asked you to put together a list of dams with high to medium PIC, which dams are subject to deemed permits. My expectation, if you do this, that will be for the whole of Otago, not just central Otago, that you've done a clean sweep of the whole region so that we actually know what structures, infrastructure's in or out, or in, as the case might be, and that there'll be identification of deemed of the deemed permits as well. It would be of deemed permits as well. And I don't know what's yet meant by, the deemed permits, I don't know. We've yet to get to the evidence as to what that might look like.
Yeah.
But it could well be that for any dam structure, there are a combination of deemed permits and RMA permits.
Yes.
And we're particularly interested if a bundle of permits constitute a dam. We're also interested to know whether any of the RMA permits are subject to conditions which import the guidelines into them.
Sure, okay.
So the whole story might not be told. In fact, probably very little of any story is told on the deemed permits. So we'd be looking at to understand the whole of the consenting, story, if I could put it that way, for a dam, specifically interested in any RMA permits, which also include reference back or a tie back into the guidelines as conditions. But that, I think, I would think, and unless you've got access to the ORC database, you'll need to be working with one of their planners.
Yes, okay, yeah.
All right, Commissioner, you got any questions?
Excuse me, Your Honour, when would you like that?
When do we want that? We still want that, actually, before by Mr Curran, I would have thought. Yeah.
Yeah, what I can say without giving any evidence is that the work is well underway in terms of having identified the deemed permits from the council's database, and there is dialogue between our respective planners and experts in relation to that. So that part of the exercise is fairly well advanced.
But it may not just be deemed permits, and I can't think which structure it was now, but I thought we heard evidence about a structure which was holding a dam structure, holding two deems and two RMAs. really curious to know what conditions are sitting on those RMAs.
Yes. Mm. The other thing, just to put into the mix, my understanding is that the structures may well be permitted activities under the plan in terms of the Section 13 works or structures in the bed of the river. Mm. So I'm still trying to get my head around what the bundle of consents looks like when we hear about damming permits, and we're not there yet on that.
No, no. And I suppose you could look at the most, I don't know whether the Loganburn 1980 structure is the most recent relevant structure, but that could be under a different plan.
Yes, and that my recollection is that's not actually captured by Plan Change 7.
Because it's got no dens?
Anyway, to answer the question, we are trying to get that list ready in the next day or so. Mm. So the idea is to have the information ready before Mr. Curran appears, and he's likely to be scheduled next week at some point.
So. I think he's now put off. Yep. All right. No, you're looking a bit downcast.
No, no,
how does that sound?
So have I got this right? Every dam in Otago?
Yeah,
that's okay. Yeah,
yeah, well, I think so, because you've got to understand what the problem is that you're asking for the court either to carve out and, I guess, put under the operative plan, because that's one way to go, or to carve out with some sort of provision in this plan. And, you know, I don't know where your thinking is or anybody's thinking is. I haven't seen the issues. Mm. Not sure where you may be going. Yeah.
The task may not quite be that big if you think about PC7 as capturing only the dam permits that are deemed permits, and I don't understand any party seeking relief that would bring all dam permits as an RMA dam permits within the remit of Plan Change 7.
No.
So as I'd understood it, the process would be identifying in the list those dams that have deemed permits associated with them, which is... it's not an extensive list, as I understand it. The next task would be Mr. Sheehan adding his classification in relation to each of those dams as to whether they are a high risk or a medium risk. And then that would be the information, perhaps together with the underlying permits that would be provided, because those are the permits being captured potentially by Plan Change 7.
So, okay, no, that sounds right. I mean, I don't know whether that's a huge task, and you know, because we obviously know three catchments where we have a lot of deemed permits, but there are other deemed permits in other catchments as well. I'm not sure what the link up there is with dams. Just to be clear, we're not just looking at, you know, Cardrona, Arrow and Manahiri Kia. It's a plan for the region.
Sure. Mm.
All right. Very good. All right. So anyway, you council are quite happy. Witnesses from both sides working in together. Yeah. Okay. Good. Oh well. Question.
Yes, Commissioner. The bands you're responsible for.
Yes, Commissioner.
Do any of them have consents under the Building Act that you know?
Good question. You know, they're all. Well, yes, they must do. Horseshoe Bend was built in 1999, so that must be under the RMA, Building Act. So anything post-91, I guess, will be captured there, although there aren't many, if I remember rightly. In fact, I can tell you. But I guess Mr. Curran's going to address some of these things too. Actually, going down that, you know, the list that I've got, and it's not complete, you know, ones like Horseshoe Bend and Clyde were the only ones built since 1991, really. So they are likely to be the only ones that have been captured under that framework.
So the previous building captured dams, is that what you're saying?
Correct, is my understanding.
So it only came in the 1991 Building Act?
Yes, I guess so, yes. Yeah, they were...
Was there some other regulatory regime prior to 1991 that you know of?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay.
I'm not sure how these deemed permits tie into it, but maybe that covers some of it. I'm not sure. So.
And my second question, the five-year reviews,
yes,
of the dams you're responsible for, where are they at the moment?
Right.
In other words, do you do them all in 1 year, or are they staggered?
Oh, you couldn't commission it. Yeah, it'd just be too much of a to manage. So. Where are they? You know, I know Loganburn sits outside this, but we've just done Loganburn, so that's done and dusted for another 5 years, which is great. The Ida Valley's dams were done in 2019, so now we've just got involved in the last sort of 18 months, but now we're working through a program with them of what we need to do, Pioneer Energy ones that I'm involved in, they're staggered all over the place, but the most recent ones were done in 2019. I think they were deferred, some were deferred through COVID, but yeah, so.
I guess my interest really was if some haven't been done, and they've been done in the next couple of years, could they highlight things that get into this concern about the 6-year program? In other words, works identified that
sure.
need to be funded.
Well, I'm pretty sure that Falls Dam and Idaburn Dam, which Ian Walsh is, I'm pretty sure he did those last year as the five-yearly thing. Mm. So most definitely there'll be some issues there that need to be addressed. And I'm sorry I'm not privy to that, but, there is some quite significant works coming up over the next few years, cost-wise.
Okay. I just wanted to get some idea.
Yeah, and we're talking millions here. We're not, serious money. So just to put you in the picture, really. Mm.
No, I've asked my questions on the way through. Thank you.
Anything coming up as a consequence of the court's questions? Nothing? Well, thank you very much. That was
my pleasure.
Really helpful, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Mr. Craw,
yes.
Now call Hayden Craw. Is your full name Hayden Templeton Craw?
Yes.
And are you an agribusiness specialist with Compass Agribusiness Management Limited?
Yes, I am.
And did you prepare a brief of evidence dated the 4th of February 2021?
Correct.
And do you confirm that it's true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Now, on page one of your evidence, you prepared an 8-paragraph summary of your key points. Did you wish to read that or simply have it taken as read?
I'd like to read it, please.
You would? Okay. Well, would you please do that now?
Water, in a broad context, is the most important resource in Otago to derive production out of land, regardless of its classification. The resultant productivity is the key driver of the value of the asset. If there is uncertainty around the current or future productivity, this uncertainty is directly reflected in value people are prepared to pay for the asset. Banks undertake a comprehensive risk review when looking at a financing request. Many factors are taken into consideration, but assuming qualitative risk factors such as management, marketing, markets and compliance are met, approval and loan terms become dependent on key quantitative criteria being cash flow, security and equity. Productivity drives cash flow. Under normal circumstances, the first 5 years post-development, gradual productivity increases provide limited ability for businesses to undertake the required principal reduction. The primary industry land market has seen a significant shift from a capital-based market to a returns-based market. Where uncertainty exists, a higher return is required to offset this risk, reducing asset value and therefore available lending security. The higher the perceived risk, the higher the external equity the bank requires to reduce the likelihood of loss from a bank's perspective. The appropriate level of debt and therefore the equity for a business is intrinsically linked to cash flow. The impact of a short consent period of 6 years is that it creates uncertainty around productivity, and this uncertainty requires anyone investing to seek additional comfort. Put simply, banks have to account for the risk that at the end of year six of a water permit renewal, access to irrigation water could cease entirely. Given that irrigation development generally takes 5 years to start showing a significant return on capital, that is highly problematic. I would expect new irrigation investment to cease for farmers in that position.
Mr. Croy, I just have a couple of questions for you.
You've addressed your evidence towards the effect of uncertainty. The court's heard from a number of farmers about how they've invested significantly in infrastructure in the last half decade or so prior to this year.
Yep.
And they've done that knowing that their permits expire at the end of this year, in October. Can you explain, is there a distinction between the risk that those farmers faced this year and what you perceive as the risk in the next 6 years? And if there is a distinction, can you explain it?
Yes, I can. Just to provide a wee bit more relativity, so I was banking between 2007 and 2012, had 2 years away, and then was banking from 2014 until the middle of 2019. I guess in my opinion, the rhetoric changed over that period. So the development that was going on in 2016 and that period there, a lot of it was driven by the fact that obviously you had to know how much water you were actually using, and a lot of people back then actually couldn't quantify that. You were being told you had to use your water efficiently, which drove that development, and that efficient use was driven by the fact that, okay, we've got these consents expiring in 2021. To have access, ongoing access to that water, you need to be showing that you're already using it efficiently. So that was driving some of the behaviours there. And then we also had Plan Change 6A, which talked about the 30 units of N, and then that was driving development away from border dike irrigation into spray irrigation at that time as well, so people could get under that 30 units of N and essentially retain that right to farm. So there was going on at the same time, which was forcing people's hands. Like some of the border dike farms were well over 150 units of N on the Waitaki Plain, so they had to make significant changes to know that they still had the right to farm. So there was different pressures going on then, and so I guess versus now, and then I guess in 2021, it was never, the risk wasn't seen around losing water. It was, I guess, the rhetoric that we heard on the road shows that if you can show that you're efficiently using your water, that risk wasn't really apparent. And whereas now, it feels like the risk is more on the quantity of water and going forwards.
Okay. My second question relates to the going forwards. Are you aware that a regional council can review the conditions of a resource consent after it's granted, despite its term, and that review might reduce the allocation of water or impose flow minima that might make water less reliable?
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that presenting the same investment risk as a short-term permit?
I am aware that the opportunity to review any consent is there. I think, in my mind, it is a reduced risk if the term of water availability is longer, and the reason for that is it gives farmers time to react and respond to what's been given to them if there is a review during that process.
Okay.
So they can invest.
Thank you.
Invest. Invest, okay.
So what sort of thing might they be investing in to address the risk of less reliable water on a review?
Look, it is specific to each business, but I guess an example would be if we've got restriction of water during periods, an irrigation dam might be, an on-farm irrigation dam might be an example of what someone would choose to invest in to, I guess, get better surety of their water.
Mm. Okay. I think I have no further questions, Mark.
Mr. Moore?
I did have some questions, but they may have been answered. Just bear with me. In paragraph 9 of your evidence, you refer to water in the broad context and you note it's the most important resource in central Otago to derive production out of land, regardless of its classification. What do you mean when you're referring to regardless of its classification? Are you referring to the water or the land? Or
I'm talking to the talking about the classification, sort of the underlying soils classification.
In terms of your paragraph 21, you were addressing previous investment made in the context of cherry farms, or cherry orchards, I should say. And now my friend Mr. Page asked you some questions about what the risk profile looked like at the time that those changes were made. In your experience, and thinking back at the date ranges that you had in mind when you were referring to those developments, when were those developments undertaken?
Look, I in terms of those cherry developments, look, they've been we've seen a recent push in the recent last 2 or 3 years, something like that. But probably from 2000, like I say, I've only been banking down here from 2014. Onwards, probably 2017, we started to see increased investment into cherry orchards.
So were you involved in obtaining financing in relation to those expansions?
Personally, no. I was aware of what they'd invested, but personally, my focus was mainly pastoral-based farmers.
So you weren't involved in the risk assessments that were undertaken at the time in relation to the shift to cherry orchards?
Not directly, no.
From a financing perspective, when you're thinking about managing risk, isn't it better to know prior to significant capital investment that there may be insufficient water resource available to fully utilise that capital resource.
Can you please repeat the question?
So when you're thinking about risk, and perhaps think about two options. The first option is one where there is investment, and let's say it's investment into a new centre pivot. And that investment could occur, say, now with a potential short-term period where water is available. Mm-hmm. I want you to compare in your mind to a situation, say, in 6 years' time when there's greater certainty as to the actual availability of water. When you're thinking about risk in terms of that level of capital investment,
yes.
Isn't it better to have certainty over the water supply that is available into the longer term?
I guess the point tonight, so from a brand new irrigation development, I think you're right, but a lot of what we're talking about, they've already have existing water, and they've been, there's other drivers that are driving, telling them to drive efficiency, so they're having to invest into irrigation block, spray irrigation. So in a way that they're tied, they're stuck in no man's land. So it's, do they make a call now? And because there is, if you do develop with irrigation, you do get a, with spray irrigation, you do get a productivity lift out of that. So there is the immediate benefit. It is staggered. It does take time to achieve that. So there is the productivity lift that can be garnered, and yes, okay, you may have to deal with change in reliability, but that, at the end of the day, if you're going to have to make an investment into pivot irrigation or fixed grid or something in terms of an efficient irrigation source at some time, the thing that we're debating is whether how much of that water is available, and then you've got to decide at that time, knowing what you need to fill that gap. Is it just increased feed brought in, or is it storage? Or
so knowledge about certainty of supply is perhaps the most important factor when looking at risk.
You can never be 100% certain in the supply with water. So, look, I think knowledge is power. I don't debate that, but there's the other factors, I think, in terms of having to efficiently use that water and know what you're using is important.
If one of the purposes of Plan Change 7 was to discourage investment in new irrigation infrastructure over the short term, until such time as there was a greater level of certainty in terms of how much water was available, in your experience, has Plan Change 7 then achieved that purpose? So has Plan Change 7 put a handbrake on investment into new capital?
It has certainly muddied the waters in terms of investment options.
What does that mean?
Oh, I think when I'm sitting down with my clients now, mm-hmm. and we're looking at do we look at doing spray irrigation, or look, there's obviously other rules in terms of what you can do in terms of increased irrigated area now anyway that we've got to take into consideration. But what we're now talking about is it worth the investment? Is it worth putting pivots on, or even can we get away with a cheaper alternative such as K-line? But K-line is still, it doesn't, okay, it takes away from border dike irrigation and potentially increases the productivity, but what it doesn't do is it still isn't as efficient use of water, and it requires a significant labour input. So people will make different investment decisions based on the term of the water, knowing that if they don't have confidence around it.
So in that regard, Plan Change 7 is discouraging investment in new irrigation infrastructure in the short term?
Yes, or updating existing.
Thank you. Those are my questions.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Baker-Galloway.
No, thank you. No, that line. Sorry.
Gosh. All right. All right. Re-examination? No. Okay. So, you know, based on this, on the questions both from Mr. Page and Mr. Moore, the key investment decision is a move towards greater efficiency in the use of water. Is that the investment decision that that is the principal or most important investment decision being made currently?
You know,
that's a generalisation, I know, but...
I think so. Look, everyone's aware that longer term, the availability of water is going to be... It's not what it was, and so people are going, well, how do I maximise my output? And I talk about production. How do I maximise the output from the water I have? Water I have available. So that's efficient irrigation that drives that. So then, essentially, more efficient irrigation, more productivity, and then whether it be grass or yield, and what that's converted into, and what that then underpins is the value of the property. So what I mean by that, essentially, just take a sheep and beef property, for example. One sheep and beef property is essentially sold on a per stock unit basis. One stock unit is considered to consume 560 kilograms of dry matter per year, and that's all relative to how much the farm grows on that per hectare. So, for example, if it grew 5,600 kilograms of dry matter, which was available for consumption, that would be considered a 10-stock unit to the hectare property, and then those stock units are then what creates the end value.
Mm. All right. So your clients are generally aware that water availability is uncertain, both now and going into the future,
mm-hmm.
and that uncertainty, and indicating... I think you're nodding yes for the transcript, so just so we just say yes or no, so we actually get it captured.
Yes.
So there is uncertainty, that is not only a consequence of the regional council reviewing its. It's a consequence of both. The legislation and higher planning documents such as the EPS for fresh water. That's a yes, I think.
Yes, yep. Yes.
And as well as it is knowing that the Regional Council is going to have a new regional policy statement and a new land and water plan coming up.
Yes.
Yeah. And then added to that is flux, or flux caused by climate change, and that's a big unknown as to where we're heading in the short to medium term. Would that be fair?
I think...
Or are farmers not bothered about climate change?
Well, they are, but I guess farmers generally, there's a lot of things that farmers can't control.
Yeah.
And so they try to focus on the...
What they can.
On the what they can, or the controllables, and add in elements of control wherever they can,
mm-hmm.
To do that. And essentially that's the root cause of irrigation, why they want it, because it, essentially irrigation is an insurance policy and that they know what they can grow within with reliable water within, I don't know, 5% variance or something like that. They can be very accurate with that and run a business to that.
So the driver in the farming, in the primary sector at the moment is a drive towards increased efficiencies, both now and into the future. Is that right?
From a reliability, yes,
yeah.
To counteract the reliability of water.
Yeah. And in seeking, and in terms of what they can control, at least in the context of this hearing, is seeking an outcome which would have them have long-term consents.
Correct.
What they can't control, because again it's a function of those higher order documents, the NPSs, the regional policy statements, and the land and water statements, is the eventual outcome in terms of regulation and how that then might impact on any long-term consent which is granted.
Yes.
Yeah. And when I say they can't control it, that is not to say they can't seek to influence it and influence it quite considerably through, you know, through the public hearing process and through the courts.
Yes, yes, they can influence that process.
Yeah. And and you've acknowledged that a consequence of a review may be to change the flow and allocation regime in such a way that it impacts upon the reliability of any grant of water to an individual farmer.
Yes.
Yeah. And that is so whether they've got the consent long-term or short-term. That could be the impact of a review.
Yes, correct.
And the consequence of that is that you think that farmers will be given time to respond to the review by putting in place structures, say it's like a dam structure, which will store water to be able to be taken and used by farmers. In a way to make up any shortfall, which has taken, you know, shortfall in or any reduction in the reliability of water as a consequence of that review.
Yes, yeah, I'll provide an example of on-farm storage, which, yeah. Look, there is the water in like the Manuherik here, for example, isn't 100% reliable now. They've already talked about where it comes under certain restrictions. So there is farms who have modelled out, based on historical flow data, what is the likely term of when they would come under restrictions, and trying to... There's always a level. You're not going to 100% provide for the 1 in 50-year event in terms of a drought, but trying to put a storage facility in place that balanced out some of those risks of a shortfall of the water not being available for a period of time. So depending on how much water you needed, it might be a storage dam that covered 2 weeks worth of water or something like that to allow you to...
Anyway, what you are banking on, or if the risk that you say your clients are willing to accept, is a risk that you will be given, your clients will be given time to retrofit storage facilities on farm in order to meet any reduction in reliability of supply. Is that what you're saying?
Storage facilities won't fit everyone's business, but I think there is going to be an impact in whether it's storage facilities around increasing, about having water available for that period of shortfall, or is it a system change? And that system change is a complete... For example, if you don't have storage and you've got a... say you've got an existing stocking rate, so you've got 700 cows, and you go into a period where there's no water for a period of time, you're not sure how long that period's going to be. Those cows still need to be fed, whether it's on your farm or not, so you can bring feed in to supplement them and keep them milking and to keep earning that income. And so you can fill that gap with supplementary feed. But if you've done your homework, so your existing, you used to carry 700 cows, and you've identified that based on the minimum flow, that the potential hole in our feed curve, what we call it, is too great to fill with feed. It just, from a financial perspective, does not make sense. Then you have to completely peel back your whole business and start from scratch around something, creating a business that can actually react to these potential shortfalls.
Mm. I'd say that's a possibility. A new business model is a consequence of a review of consent conditions, and that's what you're talking about there.
Yes. Yep.
And you also touched upon you might, in addition to storage, have a look at the means of conveyance. And do you mean both the on-farm irrigation systems, whatever they are, together with the irrigation conveyancing systems, such as open races, for example?
Yes.
So you're looking at both of those?
Look, I think you need to. Like, at the end of the day...
to meet that reliability change, yes, if you like.
Yes, yeah. And I think, look, at the end of the day, I've talked about, so the water and the reliability of the water underpins the value of the farm, and the value of the farm is essentially what... That's the bank's security mechanism, is the value of that farm. So if the water, or the water that's provided to those farms, in a roundabout way, they need to keep investing in those schemes to make sure that the value in the farms is retained.
Mm. And when you say keep investing in the schemes,
the conveyancing of the water too.
The conveyancing of the water. And so some people might be taking off the large schemes, and heard about large schemes like the Maniatoto Irrigation Race, they're the large schemes, and then other people might themselves just simply be doing taking from a water body.
Yes.
Yeah. And so there's with the potential for a review coming up under a land and water plan, there is whatever that results in may be quite significant change and ongoing change to irrigation systems.
Yes.
Yeah. And you see, that's what the court has to weigh up. It's part of the case.
Yep.
There's this huge desire to have security of supply through a long-term consent, which supply seems only secure until the first port of the first review. And then it becomes insecure unless farmers can... invest in irrigation systems, conveyancing systems, storage systems to meet a review.
Yes.
And so that's the, those are the two cases. That would be a fair summary?
People have been, I talk to my clients now, and they're kind of stuck in no man's land.
I get
like
that.
They can't.
Yeah.
They've got people who, they've got no surety around. There's always a risk with farming, and even I'll take a step out to the side at the moment. Like, there's all these other things being thrown at them around synthetic N and nutrient loss and that type of thing. So this is one small part of what everything
that's
else being chucked at us. But that they, with this uncertainty around water, they're just stuck. It's really hard to sell farms. It's hard to get people to put a fair value on their farm. Like, there's been very few sales, and then valuers are going, well, I can't really understand the implication of Plan Change 7 yet. I'm going to put a massive disclaimer on the front of my valuation, and then what banks then do is go, okay, our loan to lending value ratio has to reduce because there's this whopping big disclaimer here because of the uncertainty. And it just creates a whole heap of, there's a tenseness and people are wanting to move forward. So I guess if the longer term consents are granted and then they show intent. Look, farmers are a resilient bunch and they will adapt and develop. And we talked about dams being intergenerational. Farms are intergenerational too. So they know the importance of making sure that they invest in the farms and keeping them relevant. And so if they've already made some investment now, we're in a good payout time from a, particularly from a dairy perspective and things like that. So they have the ability to do it. And then so... when 2023 comes on, or 24, whenever the land and that plan comes in, they're not having to do as drastic changes, because there's always going to have to be that. There's going to be a drive from border dike, uncontrolled water use to spray irrigation anyway. So the changes, there's going to be changes going forward that need to be made anyway, so the change isn't going to be as big. And if you've got a consent that expires in 3 years, if I'm sitting in the bank's shoes, they're going, how do we actually support these people if we don't know?
Mm.
We've got, at least that way, so if it's, you provide a 15-year consent, for example, we've got 10 years to enable them to work through the process so we can provide funding over that period, whereas if it's 2 years, everyone's just going to be stuck in limbo until we can get to 2026 before we can then extend out. And then so in that period there, how are people going to sell their farms? How are they going to get confidence around moving forwards? How do we do family succession? It just becomes really, really difficult in that.
And then how do you, and that's the difficulty, isn't it? There is an event horizon which people are planning for or unable to plan for, which looks like a 5 to 6 year period, which is a very short period.
Yeah.
And then you've got the wider event horizon, anywhere up to 35 years in terms of where people are wanting their consents to go.
Yes.
But where there is a possibility of review on consents, thus reducing reliability of supply, reducing productivity, reducing the, criteria perhaps about which banks were lending money.
Yep.
All of that. So that's sort of the broader, the wider event horizon.
Yes.
And so the question is, what should you be managing for? And whether the security that farmers think they have in gaining a long-term consent is that secure? And that's what the case is all about.
Yes. Yeah. And look, I guess you look at we're in 2016, and the biggest thing in the headlight is Plan Change 6A and the 30 units of event, and that was going to completely change everything. And this has now come along, but it wasn't. We didn't know this was going to come along in terms of this Plan Change 7 and the implications it was going to have. So, in my mind, there's always going to be these changes thrown at us, and we can't be living in fear of those forever. So it's just around maximising the ability for farmers to be able to react. In a positive way, and allowing people to support them in a positive way. And I think if we get longer term consents now, what it's going to allow people to do some investment. It's going to drive good behaviours, because they're going to be farmers are going to be thinking, I need to get as many I's dotted and T's crossed and show what I can do and what I can manage at that time. And then they're also going to have if be able to continue to get as much information about their own business, so when these changes do come, they'll then know around how they actually can react.
But the thing is, they may not. I mean, we've heard from others that farmer expectation was driving a lot of the investment, prior to October of this year, the expectation being nothing will change. You get your long-term consents, you start to invest on the assumption that there is a reliability of supply, and yet people are saying, well, we know that could change, but so could permits not being reconsented in 91, at the end of this year also
yes.
not change, and yet to the extent that it actually informs people's expectations and people's behaviours, it's questionable. The expectation was nothing would change.
I guess it depends on who you're talking to.
It does depend on who you're talking to, doesn't it? Yeah.
I think the rhetoric that was coming from council before, it's changed in the last 18 months, in my opinion, we had live examples that longer-term consents were being granted.
Yeah.
Like 15, 25-year consents. And I guess when I was sitting in the bank's shoes, you're looking at what are the risks here from an ongoing basis. And you're looking at the whole heap of different factors, but all essentially comes back to I guess, consent rollovers and compliance, right to farm, all those sort of things get thrown into that bucket. But and when we're in the road shows and the focus that is being forced is you've got to use your water efficiently, you've got to know how much water you're using.
Mm.
Otherwise, you might not get it in 2021. So that's what drove all that other behaviour. And then probably some of the... We've seen a few false starts as well, so perhaps some of the lackadaisical approaches by some of the people you may have spoken to.
I don't know. But it is fair to say that behaviour has also been... is in response to council policy, which is to improve efficiencies, which people have been doing.
Yes.
Yep. Anyway, as a matter of interest, you said, talking about the input of... I think it was you who were talking about the input of N... in the Waitaki Plains, did you talk about that?
Oh, I talked about the N loss on some of the border
properties. N loss is 150 kgs per hectare per year in the Waitaki Plains?
Yes.
Is that on this side of Otago or that side of the Canterbury Regional Council?
That property is in Otago.
That's in Otago.
Yeah.
And border, you mentioned border diking?
Correct.
And what's on that land? What's that?
Dairy cows?
Dairy cows, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But so, just to carry on that, so what you then did a model around the cost of converting to spray irrigation, and you could model out what was going to change through Overseer, and that, knowing that people had to be under that level for 2021, it drove some investment, but also what it did, it stopped saleability on those farms. So for a period there when people were... I know that 30 units of N are still... Well, it's out here now.
It's here.
But there was farms, border dot farms, people would think, I don't want anything to do with these farms now. And while that's relevant, it's around... But same sort of thing fits. And some of the ones we've got here. With all this uncertainty in terms of the 6 years, people are going to go, I don't want anything to do with these farms. So people are trapped not being able to sell, and people don't want to buy them.
Yeah. So that's a
point. They're disclaimers on the valuations at that time.
Well, they were, so they're saying they have to, this is what drivers, or this is what levers they can pull to achieve 30 units of N. And in some cases, it wasn't possible.
No.
The economic viability fell off a cliff at about... Excuse the terminology, but had about 40 units of N on some of those lighter soils in Ovato.
All right, well, I haven't got any questions. You have any questions?
I just had one. I mean, we've been talking about plan changes, but there's the bigger picture with the land and water plan coming down the pipe, and there's the government... national policy statements and new regulations as well. So how does that get factored into this question of investment?
I'm reliant.
In terms of the banks and the kind of advice that you would be giving.
Yep. Look, that is outside my my scope. So when we come in, we're forming a team of people who can provide the answers for all those, and we need to take them into consideration. So we'd employ someone else to provide from what this could be the potential implications of this. So at the moment, for example, when we'll bring in someone like an environmental planner or something like that in terms of some of the regulations that we're facing there.
Right. So you're still getting on top of this, but this is what you see will be the next step potentially.
Oh, very much so. Look, and so we need to be eyes wide open going into any investment. What are the potential risks here, and if that risk comes to fruition, how do we manage it?
So would it be fair to say that people were perhaps a bit in the banking community and the advisory community have been a bit blindsided by some of the things that have happened in the past on the regulatory front?
Or naive might be a better word, to think that nothing would change in terms of contaminant regulation or water quantity regulation.
I think they knew there was there's always a risk there, but probably the extent of the potential change has become more apparent.
So that had been assessed as low risk, but now looking forward,
yes.
What sort of risk factor would you put on it now?
Yeah, look, so in 2017-18, when the messaging that we were receiving was, it was around, okay, support your farmers to use the water efficiently and they'll get longer term consent, so that you were comfortable with that, because if you supported the irrigation development, you knew the productivity that was going to come off the back of it, so you could do longer term modelling and be comfortable with that and stress test that modelling. And now you think, well, that longer term water reliability is not there. There's obviously potentially a change in 2024 when that end of water plan comes in, so our modelling has to take in more shorter term, is looking a lot shorter, but it's also around how do you manage the risk within that term. So like I said before, it potentially drives different investment decisions, which at the end of the day might not be the best outcome long term, but they're being forced to do that short term.
Okay, thank you.
Those are the court's questions. Anything arising? All right, thank you very much for your evidence.
Thank you.
Ma'am, do you want to proceed to have Mr. Dicey sworn in, or would you prefer to take the luncheon adjournment at this point?
I might as well just box on with Mr. Dicey.
Yep. Call James Dicey.
Information, please. I do.
Is your full name James Dicey?
Yes.
And are you the owner of Great Vision Limited?
Yes.
And did you prepare a brief of evidence dated the 4th of February 2021?
Yes.
And do you confirm that it's true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
Now, at the start of your brief of evidence, you prepared a summary of some 7 paragraphs. Did you wish to read that?
No.
And do you wish simply to take your evidence to be taken as read?
I do.
Thank you. Well, I've got no further questions for you, Mr. Dicey. So,
Mr. Page,
please remain where you are.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honour. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just like to start at paragraph 29 of your statement of evidence. And in this paragraph, you indicate that their previous survey indicated approximately 40,000 hectares of land suitable for production of summer fruit.
Correct.
And then you go on to note in your last sentence, a key determinant of this is the availability of sufficient water to enable the growth of the grapevines. Now, was the 40,000 hectares correlated to availability of water at the time, or is the availability of water the determining factor as to what proportion of the 40,000 hectares of land could be used?
There were a range of factors that were considered in the assessment of the 40,000 hectares. Reason for the survey being done in the first place was to understand the impact that Lake Dunstan would have on the Cromwell Basin, and one of the sales pitches that was made to the farmers at the time was the availability of water. So one of the factors that was included within that, beyond aspect, altitude, soil type, was certainly water as a key determinant for being able to grow stone fruit, pit fruit, cherries, etc. in Central Otago.
Let me just reflect if I've understood what you're saying. So that at that point in time, there was sufficient water available for 40,000 hectares.
So if water was made available, then 40,000 hectares could be used to grow stone fruit or pip fruit or summer fruit.
Right. So the 40,000 hectares of land was purely the land available or perhaps well suited for grapes, but its utilisation would be dependent on water being available.
Correct, but the point with the dam particularly and the other permits that were around at the time was that it was the assumption that water would be made available as part of the upsell with the dam back to the community, given the land that they were losing as a consequence of it being buried.
And did that happen, or has that happened in practice in terms of water being made available from the dam?
Yes.
And in terms of future production or future water availability, what's your understanding in terms of future water availability?
Well, that's, I guess, one of the purposes of this hearing and the consents and the terms associated with those consents, but I am aware that Contact Energy, who is the operating easement over the dam, has relatively recently released a water statement where they have indicated they're going to fight a little bit more strongly to retain more access of water in the dam. A bit of a death of by a thousand cuts from their perspective. I will, however, say that the Clutha River, on the flows that I've done at the Clyde Dam, or the Clyde area for Neewa, the whole grape industry, which is some 2,000 or 1,930 hectares, takes equivalent at an average minimum flow of 8 hours of water out of the entire dam. So the total water used, particularly by grapes, which is my area of expertise, does not compromise the flow that's required out of that river.
I want to move forward to your paragraph 34. And towards the end of that paragraph, you provide some comparisons between the efficiencies of different farming systems, and you note that a conversion of pasture to grapes might yield a 75% irrigation water saving. Now, when you've done your calculations in relation to the water savings there, have you taken into account the water that's used for frost fighting, or are you just looking at the irrigation demand?
Just the irrigation demand.
And do you have any working knowledge of the water volumes that are required for frost fighting, or is that outside of your expertise?
No, it's actually within my area of expertise, and I'm sorry, Mr. Page, I've made a bit of an omission here. I should have actually included the fact that I have omitted to include within my evidence evidence on frost fighting and its potential impact in the area in central Otago. I have read Dr. Jordan's evidence, which I understand the court's already heard previously, and agree with the information he's got in there. I have designed and worked on designing frost fighting systems previously as well, and the 25,000 litres per hectare per day is a figure solely relating to irrigation usage and not frost fighting.
What would the comparable frost fighting number B?
That's a very difficult question to answer, Council, I'm afraid. If I was to look at the total water or the total number of frosts that we would typically budget for, it would be 30 nights. If you then assumed 8 hours of frost fighting per night for each one of those, which I think is probably on the conservative or high side, every planted hectare of grapes in central Otago using a 4 to 5 millimetre an hour sprinkler uses between 40 and 50,000 litres per hour. I've actually done some analysis prior to coming here, and based on the number of hectares that I manage, out of the some 300 hectares that I manage, currently 52 hectares of that, or some 17%, use the water frost fighting. We don't have accurate data in central Otago as to the exact volume of water that is used, the exact area that is being used, uses water for frost fighting. But assuming my vineyards are representative of central Otago, and it is an assumption, I'll stress, then that means some 328 hectares would have water frost fighting in central Otago. being 17% of the 1,930 hectares. You can gross that number up, 328 times 30 days times 8 hours times 50,000 litres and arrive at a number. I'm sorry, if I had a calculator, I'd be able to do that calculation for you right now, but that would be the calculation I'd undertake. That'll give you the total quantum of water that would be used, and that's both for spring and autumn frosts.
I wonder whether we might give you some homework over the lunch break to provide the frost fighting number. I can't quite.
If I grab my phone, it's got a calculator on it. I can do it for you right now.
Very good.
Is that all right?
If I,
ma'am, Your Honour? Yeah. Or I could do it over the lunchtime for you if you like as well.
We'll do it over the lunchtime.
No problem.
Yeah.
That was my last question, so.
Okay, all right.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Questions?
No questions, thank you, Mum.
Right, so we'll just take lunch.
And, no problem.
And you can set to in your homework. And to be clear, what would you like the witness to do, just to calculate?
The litres of water used per day for frost fighting per hectare to provide full context in relation to the comparison between say pasture or cherries and grapes.
So comparison between pasture and is it cherries or is it grapes or is it both?
Well, it's both.
Right. Cool. All right. You good with that?
I'm not quite sure where Council's going with this, Your Honour. Perhaps he'll make it a little bit clearer for me. But
can you do the math?
I absolutely can do the math.
No, I'll just do the math.
Yep.
You don't
yep.
have to worry about where he's going. I do, but you don't.
Thankfully.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. And we're adjourned, I think, to 2 o'clock.
All rise.